Hello, I'm presenting today on behalf of Kate Mackey, who can't be here. She was the principal investigator in the PromGP study. So let me just work out which one to press. That one's obvious. That's the disclosures in relation to the project. What was the PromGP study? We have presented a little bit before at other ASHRAMs, but to go through the background, it will help a bit. So PromGP stands for the Pharmacist Review of Patients in GP Clinics. And what we were looking for was targeting people at a really high risk of a medication-related problem and seeing if there'd be an impact of a pharmacist one-on-one conversation at that GP clinic. So we got three Melbourne high caseload GP clinics, and we started back in 2016. Continued 2017, we managed to get a pharmacist in Sydney, so we got a few patients from there as well. Who was these people that might be at high risk? We decided that they'd have to fit at least one of these risks, so they had to be over the 50. We thought perhaps polypharmacy, which would be more than five medications, not including their antivirals, comorbidities, more than three, not including their HIV. Perhaps they'd been in hospital recently, they were taking a drug that needed therapeutic drug monitoring, those kind of patients, so at high risk of a medication-related problem. So what happened? So we did that one-on-one conversation in the clinic with the patient. If there was anything then and there that we could chat with the patient about, sorting things out, then we did that. But we prepared a report for the GP on the day of medication-related problems that we'd found. And we established, And we decided to make the medication-related problems, we put them in a risk between low and extreme. You'll be pleased to know there weren't, I don't think, any extreme risk medication-related problems. And we used a matrix validated tool, and we got a multidisciplinary panel to triple-check some of our assessments to make sure that we weren't over-assigning risk. And we also followed the patients up 3 or 4 months after, just to see if the problems had been addressed in any way. There we go. So this is kind of a schematic of what the system was. So they were referred by the practice nurse or the GP, got consent and had a chat with the pharmacist there and then. The pharmacist also had, obviously, a look at the patient's laboratory details and medical history and such. If there's anything that they could do right then and right there, so something like you don't take calcium at the same time as dolutegravir, that's an easy fix, just do it, or a referral to a smoke-free clinic or something along those lines, they did it then and there. They prepared the report I was talking to you about before. If there was something that was really needing attention, they grabbed the GP on the day. And then there was some follow-up. So what are these drug-drug interactions? We wanted to kind of put them in context of the person rather than just saying that's an interaction in a database. So we wanted to establish, you know, how long had the patient been taking it? What was the dose? Was it related to? Had the dose already been adjusted in relationship to what else they were taking? Any lab or patient factors that would be considered? So rather than just saying it's a drug interaction in a database, and we decided to classify those as low risk or clinically significant. And this is this matrix thing, which I'll try and go through with you. It's very subjective. Having been on the panel, I can tell you that we struggled a little bit to agree. So across the top is the consequence of a medication-related problem, and down the left-hand side is the likelihood. So if the consequence of such a problem would be moderate, and it's possible that might occur, that gets you a high risk rating. So you can imagine the panel, we're like, oh, really? I don't think so. But if it's just unlikely, you get a moderate risk rating. So I suppose if the consequence is bad, then you get a higher risk rating. So who were all these people? There were 335 in total, older age, because we're obviously recruiting older aged, mostly men. They'd been around a long time, median diagnosis, since diagnosis, 21 years. Mostly had excellent CD4s and were virologically suppressed. There's a couple who weren't. Because of their comorbidities, they were seeing a number of other specialists, including ID physicians in 26% of the cases. The drugs listed there, I won't go through them. I'll perhaps just draw your attention right down to the bottom. It might give you a clue. A quarter of the cohort were taking three or more antiretroviral classes of drugs. Conversely, a quarter were able to take a single tablet regimen, so they were fairly treatment experienced, I would have said. So what were their comorbidities? The usual suspects, really. Cardiovascular type things, reflux, anxiety, asthma, diabetes is there too. 24% were currently smoking at the time they had that conversation. Now, this is a really busy slide, so don't panic. You don't have to read the detail. I think I'll point things out to you. So of all of the people, these are the co-medications. Loosely, the co-medications match the comorbidities we just mentioned a moment ago. Co-medications, median of 6. But some poor person I see was taking 16, so I'm feeling, don't know who that was, but I have empathy down the line for that person. So the important bits and bobs on the slides, I guess the slightly darker coloured figures, that's anything more than 20% of people taking that group of medications. And I'll probably draw your attention to the bottom right. 68% of people were taking at least one over-the-counter or complementary medication. Maximum of 3 by the look of things, so that's not too bad. So these are the overall results of all the different types of medication-related problems, and the orange and red are the moderate and high-risk MRPs, and obviously we're looking at the ones on the left. So overall, there are 409 drug-drug interactions amongst about 215 people, and almost half of those turned out to be clinically significant. What were the antiretroviral drug classes involved? Well, about 82% of the time in clinically significant drug interactions, antivirals were involved, as you would expect. And of course, also as you would expect, the protease inhibitors popped up the most, cobicistat and NNRTIs as well. But they're all there. Now, this is going to be a busy slide too. So these are the clinically significant DDIs involving antivirals. And much to my amazement, when Kate showed me this, cation supplements appear at the top. But I guess it's because lots of people take them. And why you think this isn't clinically significant, but obviously it must be. If someone is taking their calcium at the same time as their dolutegravir, well, that does then become clinically significant. And the others are down the list there. There's a whole bunch of different ones. Recreational drugs are right at the bottom. Just for contrast, these are the low-risk DDIs, and there's similar percentages, so the calcium supplements, cations and things, they get a low risk if the person is taking them, but they've already thought that through and they're not taking it at the same time, for example. What about drug interactions that didn't involve antiretrovirals? There's a lot less of those, about 13%. Some of the usual culprits that pharmacists think about appear on that list, so statins and warfarin. Lithium, interestingly. I suppose we were recruiting people that needed drugs that had therapeutic drug monitoring. So kind of normal drugs there that you would expect. This is the panel evaluation. So the panel met a few times and they saw in 39 patients in total, that was 238 medication-related problems that they looked at, about 12% of all of the participants. And they managed to get 12% of all of the drug-drug interactions as well. Now, this is a statistician slide, and I can't explain the table to you very well, but basically it says to me that the agreement between the pharmacist and the panel about the risk of that drug interaction, and it was fairly high, so 82% of the time the panel agreed with the study pharmacist or, in fact, rated the risk higher than the study pharmacist did. Now, what did we do about addressing our problems? So I'll go through these slowly, only because addressing something is quite challenging with these, you know, there's a vast array of different drugs and medication-related problems. How can you say that in 3 or 4 months that it was definitely addressed? Things that were definitely addressed were that example I gave you before, taking your calcium with your dolutegravir, don't do that. You've addressed it then and there, it's done. The second example would be somebody switching from their Truvada-Raltegravir combination who'd always been using sildenafil, but hadn't been told that you should perhaps reduce the sildenafil if you switch to Genvoya. So if you tell them then and there, effectively that's addressed. With respect to the inhaled corticosteroids, they were all addressed as well because the pharmacist was sort of in tune with making sure that that was drawn to the attention of the GP at the time, whether or not they specifically had anything that looked Cushing-like. If they didn't, then the pharmacist just brought it to the attention of the GP. Can we change the inhaler? Should we change the antivirals? And in one case where the pharmacist was quite suspicious of exogenous Cushing's, in fact, that was brought to the attention of the GP, and we've subsequently reported that case. That chap was admitted to the Alfred, and we sorted out his Cushing's and a few other medication-related problems, actually. So some of the others down the bottom weren't as addressed as well, and I think it's probably because of the nature of the types of things. So statins, like, did the patient even have time to have a follow-up? Lipids in the 3 or 4 months? Probably not. Did the GP have time to address that? Probably not, given the way practices work. And similarly with the blood pressure medications, perhaps they weren't attended to quite as quickly. Just a couple of things there. I guess other cohort studies, of which there's a number, where they report drug-drug interactions, they don't often think about or don't consider other non-prescribed medications, complementary medicines. They don't take into account necessarily any dose adjustments that might have been made. So they just say, atorvastatin, Genvoya, it's in the database, it's an interaction, let's just pop it in a column. Whereas we tried really hard to pop it in clinical context of the individual. Obviously, our limitations there would be that the risk assessment is very subjective. And it was quite fun having those conversations as being on the panel, just trying to agree with or not agree with how severe or not severe the risk was. And obviously, some of the time, you couldn't address those problems in 3 or 4 months. So this is the team at the Alfred asked us to put this slide in about how would you do this if you had a fairy godmother and lots of money and you could incorporate a pharmacist into your GP practice. This would be the same kind of timeline across. You would do exactly the same activities, and you'd probably once a year attempt to see the people that might be at high risk. And if you were in clinic, you could do that. If you didn't have any choice and you had to use a home medication review, you might be able to use that mechanism to see those patients as well. If you were in clinic, you could chase up after 3 or 4 months or 5 or 6 months or 12 months to see that the medication related problem, was it still there? Did it still need addressing? So it might be handy. So how would you fund that? And it's really difficult in Australia. There isn't really specific money set aside for that kind of thing. I know they have pharmacists in clinics in the UK, nothing to do specifically with HIV, they just do. You could use HMR funding, and there's this thing called PIPS, which I've had to look up and I don't really remember. It's Practice Incentives Program for GPs. It's a government-funded thing for quality improvement incentives. So apparently you could get a pharmacist that way if you were able, if you go through the red tape, it looks quite extensive. If you were lucky enough to have done all of that, perhaps if you had a pharmacist on site, you'd get medicines info quite quickly. You might get some education sessions, or you might even get some quality use of medicines. So we live in hope. So just to finish up, drug-drug interactions were identified in 2/3 of the participants, and antiretrovirals were implicated in 82% of anything that was clinically significant. And we know that prescribers in GP clinics are really good and really aware of antiretroviral drug interactions, but perhaps if you had a complete medicines review once a year or so with the pharmacist, you might find a few more that you can sort out then and there. These are the people to thank: all the patients, all the practice nurses and GPs, the panel who popped from different places to the Alfred to review things, and Olga gets a mention down the bottom there because she helped coordinate that exogenous Cushing's admission to the Alfred and sorted out a few of his problems. So that's me.